Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast.
The Daily Bacon.
To find other programmes you might be interested in, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
Hello and welcome to The Daily Bacon. And the good news is Robin is back. Been away for a couple of days.
Isn't that good news?
That is good
for
news.
For everyone concerned.
And we've got a new thing, of course, on the podcast. The podcast, is, as we've explained many times, are our favourite bit, Robin. Certainly the listeners to the podcast are our favourite listeners.
They are.
And we now invite you to email in under the heading Podcast Hero, and it stands out in the inbox. So bacon@bbc.co.uk. I'll read a few out. We're getting a lot from all over the world, and we'll read some out in the last link of the podcast. Robin, today's show I thought went well.
It went very well, yes.
Oh, Amanda's such a good guest, isn't he?
He is. No, sorry, I'm not really not adding anything to this, am I?
You're going
to
get some bad reviews from Podcast Heroes unless you make a better contribution than this, frankly.
It's not my fault. You make me do it.
You don't want to do it.
I don't want to do it.
Who secretly thinks Robin loves being on this podcast?
He definitely wants to do it.
I don't want to do it, really.
Do, Robin,
anyway, Amanda, you know, she was very good, wasn't she? And very funny and a very nice man.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, and so in this podcast we've got him, and we've not done a whole podcast of Stuart Lee. He was really good. If you're a comedy fan and you're interested in how comedy's put together, then go online and listen to the whole interview, because he talks a lot about that. But there's a bit of an overlap with Stuart Lee in this podcast, and then there's help on the end, and then your emails. Here is Armando Iannucci. Tell me now what you're struggling with, and between this week's panel of assembled experts and you, the wider listening community, the family, will try and see you right. Armando Iannucci, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I was very moved by that appeal there that you just put out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I tried to, yes. I mean, I...
Sounds very sensitive.
Yes, I hope so. Yeah. Sensitive and sincere.
Yes. Yeah. For me, it's the spice drawer.
Yeah.
The drawers that you put your spices in are never quite big enough for the bottles of spices that you buy at supermarkets, so they always end up on the side.
Yeah, they do.
And there must be some way of sorting that out.
But you're right, typically people leave them out, don't they?
Yes, and they dry. They go dry.
They do, and they look a bit messy after a while.
Yes. Well, so if only we could, this is part of big society, isn't it? If we could come together and come up with a uniform spice system.
We are all in this.
We're all in this together.
If you can help out Armando Iannucci in the spirit of the big society and in the spirit of help, then
yes.
Text now 85058. What should he do with his spice jars? Now, Armando, you've got a lot going on. I almost don't know where to begin.
It doesn't feel it, because you do these things. Some things you do months in the past, and others, like the book, you know, we actually wrote about 7 or 8 months ago, but it happens to be coming out now at the same time as the Alan Partridge stuff is happening. But you don't plan it that way.
No, I think you have another quite a few other projects on the boil, including, have I got this right, a Thick of It style show for HBO in America?
I don't know how thick of it will be, but it's certainly, we're doing a pilot for a comedy series for HBO set in the Vice President's office, and we shoot that next sort of February, March. And it's a female vice president. You see her, called Selina Meyer, and you see her and her staff, and we just follow their... Because it's a strange office, the vice president.
Isn't it?
It's often occupied by people who were once powerful in something like the Senate, were used to ordering people around, are technically only a heartbeat away from supreme power, and yet find it very difficult to work out what on earth they're for and what to do.
But Sarah Palin, in the only one of the few things she's ever said that I completely agreed with and understood and actually made me laugh, was when, before John McCain picked her,
yes,
she was asked, would you consider running for the vice presidency? Mm. She said, I would do, but I've got absolutely no idea what the vice president does.
And that's because no one has. It's not in the Constitution. It doesn't describe what the vice president does. Technically, the vice president is president of the Senate, which means in the event of a tie, the vice president has the casting vote. They can stand in for presidents at funerals, which is a standing joke. But on the other hand, it can be anything. So if you have a president like George Bush, who was fairly, shall we say, relaxed about the day-to-day running of government, he allowed Dick Cheney to almost become an alternative president. So Dick Cheney was driving a lot of domestic and foreign policy through in America at the time.
Yeah, well, you see, that's the thing. He was a very powerful vice president.
Yes.
And there have been vice presidents that were not very powerful and that history has completely forgotten.
Yes, the Dan Quayle and Walter Mondale effect. Yes, who then run for president and get inaugurated.
Exactly.
So it's,
I mean, Al Gore was a well-known vice president. But again, I'm not entirely sure what he did for 8 years. I know what he's done since. I don't know what he did then.
They tend to be in charge of space programs. That's what happens. They come into office and presidents say, no, you're going to be different from all the rest. You are going to, I'm going to give you some kind of, well, not economics, because I want to do that. Not foreign, because I want to do that. Not education, because I want to do that. Well, space. We'll give you space. So the big one was Lyndon Johnson, who was a powerful figure in the Senate, ran the Senate, got civil rights legislation through in the mid-50s, early 60s, was a major Senate figure, majority leader, then became Kennedy's vice president and was put in charge of NASA. That was his job.
You see, to me, it looks like a nice job in that you don't have the responsibility. So the job of being president involves some quite tough decisions. And
yes.
Whereas you didn't really have to make any as vice president. You get the motorcade, you get Air Force Two.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
You get a great big Secret Service detail, which must be great for the ego. That must be exciting.
Dick Cheney enjoyed his motorcade, and because we found
that is that on the record?
Yeah. When we were filming In the Loop and we were out in Washington, we had to use these police outriders in Washington, and you can't have actors pretending to be the police, so we had to have genuine ones.
Did you?
And they were Dick Cheney's. So they said, "We'll join you once we're finished with Dick Cheney." So we waited all day, and they told us he just likes to have a complete motorcade wherever he goes, even to go down and buy a bottle of milk. He'll take a motorcade. He just loved it. And then we were doing it, and we had to do the same shot again and again. So we were going round in this circle in the middle of Washington, and I just like the idea of everyone being stopped in the traffic, all the motorists just going, Dick Cheney's gone a bit mad today.
I remember that scene in In the Loop, and it's Chris Addison's character. Not called Ollie, is he, in the Loop?
Called Toby.
And is it Tom Hollander's character?
Yes.
And they're in that car and they can't believe they're in
the motorcade.
And you use it to illustrate nicely the difference between American and British politics. Because like a day later, he's in his surgery.
That's right. But also, when British politicians go out to Washington, they do get a bit starstruck. It's like...
Do they get outriders?
I don't know if they get outriders, but I know there are outrider disputes within Washington, and certain people, foreign dignitaries, get slightly miffed if they don't have the cavalcade of three cars in front and three cars behind them and 15 outriders when they hear that some other president of some other country slightly bigger than theirs got a slightly longer motorcade. So there is that. There is also... people told me that whenever Blair came out to Washington to meet up with Bush, he suffered at the end what they called White House lockjaw, which was just him being unable to speak because he was so excited by being in the Oval Office. So an air of kind of... So there is that. It's like us going to... taking our kids to Disneyland or us going to Hollywood or something. The politicians do get very excited out in Washington.
It's interesting in terms of the power play. You can see how the American presidents, the American government, to some extent controls and influences other governments around the world. If you went there, you can imagine, if you went there as prime minister and you were met by a great big motorcade and you were swept into the White House, that you would feel kind of excited, but also slightly on the back foot, wouldn't you?
Slightly on the back foot, slightly excited, and don't forget, also jet-lagged.
Mm.
You've flown to them, so you've done the trip that is your day is now 38 hours long, and you can't think properly and you can't be as firm and as decisive as you normally are when you're jet lagged.
No,
I have this theory that that's why the American colony is so powerful and that all decisions are made by jet lagged people who come there.
I think it's not a bad theory.
Yes.
Wow them with a motorcade.
Yes.
Exhaust
them.
Exhaust them. And
exhaust,
then they'll do exactly what you
and
say.
And surprise them. Yes.
I've got this idea about war in Iraq. All right.
Yeah, whatever.
Can I get some sleep?
Yes.
When David Cameron became Prime Minister, you see, this is one of the many reasons I should never be at the top of politics. Is the only thing that appeals to me about it is stuff like outriders and all that. And David Cameron, his first day in office, he dismissed the outriders. I watched the news.
Yes.
And Gordon Brown went to the palace with outriders, swept into the palace. And then David Cameron's car was stuck in traffic. Do you remember?
That's right, yes, yes.
And I thought, well, when he leaves the palace, obviously he'll then have... He's not technically PM yet, so presumably he gets them when he comes out of the palace. And he came out and he didn't have them. And it turned out he dismissed them because of this austerity drive. And I thought, what's the point in the job if you're going to do that? I mean, that's the real perk.
Do you know, we dismissed a story in the thick of it because I thought it was just... no one would believe it. The minister was decided to walk to the House of Commons rather than take the car. And his advisors tell him that, in fact, that's fine, but he will be followed by a car containing his red dispatch box, because the papers are actually Crown property and that's why they have cars. And I dismissed that as being a bit silly, only to find out that since, because of this austerity drive, government ministers now take the bus and the train and walk to their work. There is still a network of cars all bustling around London taking red dispatch boxes to their house and back into the House of Commons.
Isn't that interesting? Which is a bit like the old David Cameron story about when he cycled into Parliament and the car was behind him with the clothes. I once saw George W. Bush's motorcade going through London. He was at a do, I think, at the American Ambassador's residence in Regent's Park, and he was staying at the Palace. Remember that state visit he had?
The state visit, yes, as opposed to the other visit.
I know, what is the difference? I think the difference is he stayed at Buckingham Palace, isn't it?
Yes.
And I saw his motorcade, and I was on Baker Street, which sort of between the two. And his motorcade was something like 30 vehicles. But there weren't that many police around. The police were moving, but they were non-stationary. And so I could walk up to his car, and it was going quite slowly in the motorcade.
Right.
And it was quite near the front.
And you could tell which car was his.
Yeah, there are two. Yeah. But if you're right there, you can just see through the window.
Yeah.
And I thought, I'll get a proper look. So I stepped into the road, and him and Laura in the back, and the driver swerved the car at me.
Well, you could have been anyone.
I know. He tried to take me out.
Yeah.
And it, so much so, it forced me to jump back onto the pavement. But I did.
Did five other people then leap out and pin you to the ground?
I mean, I'm lucky nothing else happened in a way.
Start dissecting you just to make sure. Yeah.
I managed to cause the President of the United States of America a moment's discomfort. lots of people are texting you about your spice jar problem. You're saying earlier that your drawer isn't big enough.
I'm looking for Spice Solutions. I'm thinking of setting up a company called Spice Solutions.
It alliterates beautifully.
Yes.
The solution to the spice problem is easy, says Jan in Leicester. Freeze the spices in small containers. Mm-hmm. You can use them without defrosting them as they contain no water and they don't lose any flavour.
Righto.
But
it's a lot of work, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is.
And how do I freeze them? Do I take them out their glass jars?
Yeah, you must do, yeah. And then put them into a smaller container.
Put them into sort of Tupperware, put them in the freezer.
Give them their own little section within a Tupperware container, all the different spices.
Yes.
And then seal that and then put it in the freezer.
Or put them in the containers that you put ice cubes in. Put just different spices.
That's
mini little spice trays.
That's a really good idea. I mean, I bet you Jan in Leicester thinks that's a brilliant idea.
Yeah, phone in now for your spice solutions. Back to you, Richard.
Thank you, Armando. Put the spices in a bigger cupboard, buy a bigger spice rack, etc.
Buy a bigger spice rack again, you know, thinking outside the envelope there.
Given that this conversation has become a little bit Alan Partridge, we might as well talk about your new show, the new Alan Partridge, which is online, paid for by a very famous Australian beer company.
Is that how we're allowed to describe them?
I haven't asked my editor for permission to. He says I can say it once, Foster's.
Okay, and then we need never mention them again.
Never mention
them. Yeah, they're also up on YouTube as well, so you...
And there they are. Oh, and what is the thinking behind this?
Well, the thinking really is two things. One, Steve and I just thought it'd be great to bring Alan back, but we didn't want to do a massive all singing, all dancing, he's back on television kind of, you know. We just thought it'd be nice to... Because privately, we're always, not reminiscing, but speculating as to what Alan is up to now. So in the back of our heads, there is this little running biography going on. So we thought it would be nice to have a little miniature insight into where he is now. And from my perspective, I just thought it would be interesting to see what it's like doing comedy online. Short form, 10, 12 minute comedy, just whether there is an audience for it or an appetite for it.
Well, let's play a clip. And so he's now working at North Norfolk Digital Radio.
North Norfolk Digital, it's one of these online streaming with webcams. So the webcams are set up and you can watch.
We have a number of webcams.
And rather like the spice rack situation, he does take in calls. There is one episode where he's in the middle of a phone in on how often should you wash your towels. And
that does sound a little bit like our help section.
Yeah.
We would do that.
And he does a show called Mid-Morning Matters with Alan Partridge.
And how popular has it been?
It's been very popular. I mean, again, it's a completely new territory for me. Again, I don't know how to measure it, but the first one, and it's only been available, I think, in the UK and Ireland, even though it's on YouTube. Although I'm sure if you keyed in YouTube, Alan Partridge, Mid-Morning Matters, you'd find, if you're in America or something, you'd find a version that's up there. But it's got, I think, something like 250,000 hits in the last 4 or 5 days, and it's been in the YouTube top 10 all week. So
great.
And there's 12.
Will you bring it out on DVD eventually?
I think we will. Yeah. And there'll be, there was loads of stuff that we shot, so there's more to come. Yeah.
Is it, with the think of it, something like 20% is improvised, I think, isn't it? Something like that. So with this, is this all scripted? Is Steve improvising?
It's all scripted, but the scripting and re-scripting goes up on right up to the last minute. So even on set, as we're recording, we're juggling about with lines, changing lines, and usually his guests, as it were, on the stage are other comedy performers. So we're able to kind of do a little bit of rewriting of the script before we record it, and so on.
It's such a good creation, isn't it? And Steve is so good at playing it that you might as well just keep revisiting it. You might as well just keep
doing
it.
Well, I think, you know, it sort of feels like Alan has been with us for decades, and I think he has, actually. I think it is 20 years since he first appeared on the Hour. Yeah. But we haven't done that much with him. You know, we did a couple of radio shows, we did a couple, 3 TV series of 6 each, and a couple of little guest appearances. So we haven't flogged him, and I think that way we've allowed ourselves the benefit of being able to bring them back every 4 or 5 years.
Do you go back and watch the old stuff at all?
I don't go back, but I occasionally catch it on Gold or whatever it's called now. Dave.
I lose track of what
Dave
it's called, but yeah.
Nunchuck or something.
And do you like it when you see it?
I do, actually. It's been such a long time since I've seen that I've completely forgotten what happens next.
Right.
So I'm watching it as a viewer. Sometimes I watch it and think, oh, that scene was a bit too long. We should have cut that bit. But once somebody as a specialist subject on Mastermind did Alan Partridge, and I just thought, right, well, let's put this to test. So I tried to watch it while he was answering the questions, and he got more than me. There were some questions.
Fans know more than you know, yeah.
The trivia, I just couldn't remember.
The movie, Alan Partridge movie, is something that obviously has been rumoured for an awful long time. Mm-hmm. Will it happen? Is it in development? What stage are you at?
We're in the process of writing a script, and that's all. There are all sorts of theories and rumours that I hear about it. But the fact is, we would love to do one, but there's no point doing one until we've written something that we think, yeah, this merits being a film as opposed to an extended TV episode. And this is something where we feel that it hits the level of the comedy that we got in the TV show.
Have you got a situation yet?
We have. I'm not going to say what it is, but it's not Alan Goes to the Moon or Alan Goes to Hollywood or anything like that. It's nothing.
That is the way to ruin a comedy, isn't it? Well, they did with Only Fools, and they'll go off to Spain. And
exactly. I was going to say we tried to avoid that within Loop, but of course it's the thick of it goes to Washington. that aside... We very much want to make it Alan in the world that he knows best.
So he's broadcasting. He's on the radio, is he, essentially?
There's elements of broadcasting involved, yes. Okay. Other than that, I won't say. But so we're just in the course of writing it ourselves on spec at the moment, and then we'll see what happens.
It's always been a bit of me because I loved the Radio 4 series. I loved all the Partridge, but the Radio 4 series, and then the old TV chat show.
Yes.
Which I did re-watch recently.
Oh, did you? Sort
of, it's one of my comedy DVDs, occasionally when I come in drunk with some friends. And it's so good. And there's always a bit of me thought, oh, if only he could get a chat show again.
Oh, you reckon?
But it's not. I assume that's impossible, isn't it, really?
But it would have to be on some cable channel, some satellite, Virgin, whatever.
I mean, his story has been on a steady decline, hasn't it? He's on Radio 4 and he has a chat show and then he has
I think he still records 100 episodes of Skirmish, the military-based quiz show for some minor channel.
But he's still got that contract, has he?
Yes.
Oh, that's good news.
Where he says things like, Margaret, you have deployed 5 heat-seeking missiles, this for the travel kettle. things like that.
When do you think we will see the film? Do you have any idea when it will be ready or when you will actually start making it?
I don't know. I think we just want to get a script ready and hopefully we'll have one done in the next 4 or 5 months. I mean, the slow progress is really because we've got other things, and you know, I'm going off to shoot the HBO pilot, and Steve's got filming to do.
And Thick of It's coming back as well, isn't it?
And we have a very first Thick of It writers meeting tomorrow.
Do you?
Yes. So we crack open the Thick of It box tomorrow.
Now, there's a lot of questions to ask you about that. So the Partridge film potentially could be filmed next year. So
I'd be surprised if it was that quick. But it needs people to fund it. And, it, you know, we haven't gone down that route at all, really.
The British Film Council's been scrapped, hasn't it? Did that part film In the Loop?
It contributed to In the Loop, yeah. So I was very upset to hear that because things like a lot of these cuts, I feel, have just not been thought through, in that they are great headlines on a piece of paper that a minister has to hand back to Number 10 saying, look what I've done. But when you analyse them, the UK Film Council put a lot of money into films that then made money and that brought work and jobs and investment to British film. I suspect what will happen is they will shut it down, and in 3 years' time they will open something called the British Film Financing Commission or something.
Okay.
That sounds roughly like the UK Film Council.
Do you think these things were shut down out of ideology, out of a dislike of bigger government, a dislike of quangos?
Well, I think the cuts were rushed so much that and okayed so quickly that I think if you read the small print, you see there is a sort of an ideological bent behind them. I mean, the big untold story, I think, is the 30% cut for council funding, because those cuts are the ones that, when those come through, will have the real effect on people's lives. And in fact, it will be the councils that get the blame for that, not the ministers.
So it was a very interesting report on Newsnight two nights ago. It was the opening report, and it was about council cuts.
Yeah.
And they went to a town, I think it was in Nottinghamshire, with high crime rates, and the council, they're going to have to switch off quite a few streetlights at night. I mean, that's the sharp end of it. That's the reality, isn't it?
Yes, cuts. Yes. And those are the cuts that people really will feel.
You voted Liberal Democrat, I think, didn't you, publicly in the general election?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes. I broke a promise I made to myself never to reveal how I was going to vote. But then breaking the promises is the trend these days. So
certainly for Liberal Democrat.
Yes, certainly for...
I mean, the problem with revealing how you vote is that then people like me bring it up. Because I go through my notes of research and it's there forever now.
In my defence, not that I have to defend this position at all, I'm not a Lib Dem, in that I'm not a regular Lib Dem voter. I did think genuinely that come the last election, given how close it was, that anything that would bring about our system of hung parliament that would force parties to talk to each other would be a good thing. I wasn't expecting this.
Well, now, I mean, technically, the things that you're concerned about, the council's cuts, the British Film Council are being scrapped, they're things that are technically being done by the party that you voted for, aren't they?
And,
they're part of the coalition.
And also... And this is the other great sort of unreported story, is the number of things that were said during the general election by all parties that turned out not to be true. Or, more importantly, the type of legislation we're getting now that was not discussed in the last election. The reform of the NHS was not in any manifesto in the last election. The type of cuts that are coming through now were not mentioned in the last manifestos and still haven't been debated properly as to why exactly they're so deep and so fast and so quick.
Let's take some news and come back and talk some more. The other thing that was quite intrigued me is, I remember the days up to the general election, on the day of the election, the Daily Mail, a lot of papers said this, but Daily Mail on the front page said, if we get a hung parliament today, it will be exactly like Athens. There'll be riots everywhere.
Yes, and yes. Hey, the Daily Mail was right.
It just took a few months. Lots of people texting about Alan Partridge, Mid-Morning Matters.
Any Twitters?
Yeah, well, I would have thought so. Yes, actually, Twitter features...
I'm saying nothing.
No, let's leave that topic behind.
No, I'm going to leave it to tweet.
Yeah. People forget down there on Twitter sometimes that it's... You know, that it is broadcasting, isn't it? That
that's the thing. And I think, obviously not referring to current events, but I think politicians generally forget that it is a public medium. And it's not like even email, actually, which you think of as being a private correspondence.
It's a form of broadcasting.
Yes.
That's what it is.
Yes.
So with Mid-Morning Matters, which is this new online, Alan Partridge. They're 11 minutes long. And how many have you made?
There's 12 in all. We've made six, but there are 12. So we've got another week in which we're shooting.
Quite a lot of writing
six.
Altogether. That would almost be a TV series of Alan Partridge.
It nearly is, actually, yes. But because it's in this simple format of Alan doing his radio show, it's not like we have to construct a huge episode with lots of scenes and different characters all interacting.
I was going to come on to that and ask, what can you do online in this 11-minute version that you couldn't do on television? What does it allow you to
do? Well, I think the expectations are different. It's people aren't expecting that sort of constant twist and turn and bigger cast that you get in a 30-minute episode or an hour-long episode. It allows you to do something that's slightly more, maybe a taste, an atmosphere, 10 minutes of Alan's solid broadcasting performance with a few interruptions and a few hiccups along the way, rather than that different sort of discipline that you get if you're doing like a TV. And also, you're not pitching at a certain time slot. You're not, and your audience is completely unknown. Eventually it will be accessible internationally. So I've absolutely no idea.
But on television, I suppose BBC Two would be nervous to say you can have an 11-minute slot, and we don't mind if it's all shot in one room.
Yeah, but they wouldn't know where to put it because 11 minutes is difficult to deal with on television because they work in these half-hour blocks.
It has already been successful. Mm. It's interesting. Does it demonstrate a sort of evolution, really, in terms of what's happening in television comedy?
To be serious for a second, I think, as people maybe get a little bit more and more nervous about the type of comedy that can be broadcast, and, the BBC brought in some very strange Ask Stuart about these new rules and regulations about what you can and cannot say in terms of how you jokes of criticising other people and so on. But as writers maybe get a little bit nervous, I think they turn to other media to put their comedy up. But also, the way we watch television is so different now from even 3 or 4 years ago. We watch online. We download. We put it on a hard disk. We Sky Plus it. Everyone doesn't watch our programme at 10 o'clock at night or 10:30 or whatever. We watch it across the week whenever we want. It doesn't matter which country it was broadcast in. We can download it, we can get it on iTunes or whatever. So I think this is interesting, this approach to putting new comedy up online. The trick is to get people to fund it in the first place. But I think as more and more of these come up online, I think it will become the norm for people, rather than the same way that films are funded in advance and then go on and then you try and recoup your money.
And so if I was working in the BBC comedy department or Channel 4 or ITV comedy department, I'd be nervous about
I think it sort of gives a little bit more power back to the creative people behind it, to the writers and the performers and the producers, rather than being at the mercy of channel commissioners or channel schedulers.
Which you used to need. Somebody like you, a writer, creator of comedy, needed those traditional linear broadcasters.
And I don't think it'll go away. I mean, we were talking about The Thick of It. But I noticed the last series of The Thick of It went out Saturday nights on BBC Two, and I thought that probably wasn't a great slot.
No.
However, the viewing figures doubled once you added the number of people who watched it on iPlayer. So that indicates just how the people's viewing habits have changed.
But you see what I mean? If you were in BBC comedy, you might not want your Partridge experiment to succeed because more people will do it, won't they?
But then it allows the BBC to then say, OK, right, we'll put money into putting stuff up online, but we'll do it absolutely seriously and we'll put a real amount of effort behind it so that we can find the next
And then
writers.
The Murdochs will say, what are you doing online, BBC?
Yeah, shut it down now. And they do talk like that.
They do.
Yes.
It's interesting. Did you, when you made the show for the BBC, did you get a bit of interference from commissioners? Did you get them steering the show at all?
No.
Or did they leave you alone?
What, Alan Partridge?
Yeah.
No.
They always left you alone.
One moment when, I think in one episode, Alan says to Lynn, can I get a free power shower from Dolphin Bathrooms? Martin Lewis's brother-in-law got two of them. And somebody from BBC editorial compliance empire rang me up and said, we are going to have to run this past Martin Lewis. And I said, no, because he'll just, unless he's really, really happy about it, he might just go, no, and we don't want to give anyone the power to turn stuff down because it's clearly a fiction. This is a made-up world. I am Andrew Nucci. I'm not implying that Martin Lewis's brother-in-law had two free bathrooms, showers from Dolphin Bathrooms. I don't know Dolphin Bathrooms. I don't know if Martin Martin Lewis has a brother-in-law. And then he got into, because this was the height of the Bertist era of, he said, we, the programme maker, are buying the programme from you. So we are the customer here. So you will do as I say. So I said to him, fine, I'm not selling you this programme now. I'm going to sell it to someone else. So he then went, oh, all right then, put the phone down.
So, gosh. Yeah.
Oh, that's the only example I can think of. The only time I think we had any kind of interference.
But you see, I think I think because of who you are and your track record, you probably have a lot less interference than other people, which is why this new idea of just putting comedy online will become, yes, I think, increasingly appealing to people.
Well, also, you know, young writers and young comics, perhaps a little bit nervous of any perceived regime of, oh, you can't say this anymore, or you mustn't have a go at one person unless you balance it with having a go at the complete opposite of that person, may feel a little bit restricted in their output. And therefore, the idea of just going out and making something yourself and putting it up online, I think it's great.
So if in the Anna Partridge Online there's some suggestion that Martin Lewis got a free jacuzzi or something, that stays in, he has no right of reply, yeah. That's not coming out. Armando Iannucci is here, and sitting beside him, Stuart Lee. Good afternoon, Stuart.
Hello, thanks for having us.
Pleasure. We're always happy to have you on. How are you?
Well, great, thanks.
Good. Yeah. We're going to talk about your DVD in a bit.
All right.
Which I've seen that show twice now. I saw it live in Edinburgh. This is the, if you want a milder comedian, if you prefer a milder comedian, please ask for one.
Yeah.
Which you did in Edinburgh last year. Now it's out on DVD. Yeah. And it's evolved a lot.
Well, it's finished. I mean, that was the last time I did it, in April last year. That was about the last week I was doing it. I'm not doing it anymore. It's all consigned to the past. So I'm doing a new show at the moment at the Leicester Square Theatre until Christmas, which I'm working out stuff for the new telly show next year.
And Armando, you worked on the first series of that show.
Yes.
He was the executive producer, and he fought a rearguard action to prevent things like the Martin Lewis's brother-in-law shower incident happening to us. So I meant as a sort of, you know, it was a buffer. I'm sure there's things I didn't even know about.
I'm sure there's things I didn't know. Yeah. But at one point, the show wasn't happening, wasn't it? Do you remember
that?
Yeah,
well, yeah. It was cancelled for about 2 years. Yeah. It was commissioned in 2005, I think, and then it stopped for 2 years. And I wrote about it in this book. Actually, yeah. I wrote about it. I thought, if I write in this book, why was it cancelled for 2 years and then back on? Surely someone will just explain. But it's still. But I have a slightly different attitude to Armando now about it. I thought I sort of think I feel really like I'm sort of amazed to be on at all. So I kind of think, rather than getting frustrated with it, I view it in a kind of zen-like way. I view that the machinations of broadcasting as being like weather. You know, you can't really invest anything in it. It just kind of happens randomly.
I'll also find, if you wait long enough, the person who made the decision you disagree with has usually moved on to another job.
Yeah, eventually. It just goes around. I've always joked I'm on a 7-year cycle of being popular. You know, and I think it just sort of goes around. And if you keep going past about 20 years, eventually it will come back again, you know.
Yeah. And you soon become a national treasure.
That's what I'm aiming at, becoming a national treasure, yeah. But you have to not be popular as well. You have to be just unpopular enough to be a national treasure.
That's right. They have to have an edge.
But popular enough to make money.
Yeah, you can get about 50 years out of being a national treasure, whereas popularity could be over in 18 months, you know. That's the thing.
That long process, though. So it was commissioned, then it wasn't commissioned, and it just took a long time to get it on air, which is, one again, is, you know, a problem you don't have when you're making comedy for the internet,
yeah. It'd be awful if the internet wrote back and said, no, we don't like it. We're not putting this on.
The reason I'm saying the internet, quality grounds. I know. So I'm trying to avoid saying the brand of beer again.
You don't have it live either. I mean, you can just, you know, you can just sort of do a live show and it will stand or fall. You know, particularly with the internet now, with that internet, you know, there is a word of mouth thing that can get round. You know, you can be doing something and people will find out about it now quicker than they would have done before. Yeah, so you can't, you know, there's lots of ways of circumventing the kind of gatekeepers of broadcasting. But on the other hand, it's really, I mean, I'm really looking forward to making the programme and being at home for 9 months and not having to go off on tour as well. You know, and you do reach, I've noticed in the audiences, you get older people coming and younger people coming who absolutely wouldn't have known about you without seeing you on the telly, and it's really nice.
Do you get people shouting catchphrases at you?
Well, you do a bit, yeah. And actually, things you've often forgotten what they ever were, you know.
Yes.
Yeah, quoting stuff back at you. But it's, you know, it's been doing the telly put about 40% onto a live audience for me as well.
Good.
It's not like you know, where you're suddenly in stadiums, but it's been really good.
The that point about how long it took to get on television, I read a book by a comic, and I can't remember who it was some years ago, and he talked about making a TV show, and he said it was, in terms of having the idea, getting it commissioned, getting it made, getting it on television, he said it took something like 7 years, and he compared it to World War II, and he said, you know, from the invasion of Poland through the Battle of Britain and Dunkirk and D-Day through to VJ Day, you know, that was less time.
And just when you think you've got it on and ready, there's the Battle of the Bulge, you know, which you weren't planning.
Oh, man, your book, The Thick of It, The Missing...
Well, I feel no Stuart's here, I can't talk about my wares any longer. Well, I just feel that slightly like embarrassed and awkward.
No, I'm sure you'd like to read this book.
I've got one of those. I haven't read it yet, so I'm very excited about it.
See, he's bought it.
It's done like the old sort of goodies and Monty Python books.
That's interesting, a generational thing, isn't it? Because for us, if you were our age, that was what a comedy book was. It should look like the Goodies disaster movie book from 1972.
That's right.
Where every page was just rammed with loads and loads of information. Whereas now they tend to be rather,
loose.
And there's sort of some photos of the star of the thing in different outfits and some actual genuine biographical information. Whereas, that's very much got that immediately pre-punk.
Although I do like the idea of a cutout Stuart Lee.
Different
costumes you can put on.
No, but it's a good point. This is packed with material.
Thank you. We've worked on it.
You've worked hard.
We haven't tossed it off. We've actually sat down and thought about it.
Is there... I mean, it's a similar question I thought of asking about putting Partridge Online. What can you do in here that you couldn't do on the TV show? And the point I think I was making a few minutes ago is I feel as though I've got to know the characters
better.
Well,
we can delve a bit deeper. I mean, we see Terry, the press officer, her annual assessment form for when she worked at Waitrose, things like that. You know, all the stuff that Malcolm has in his top drawer about everyone, you see. And you also see Malcolm's diaries and emails.
Also, I suppose it's just sort of lucky in as much as It suits the we live in an age where we're used to politicians writing diaries or memos being leaked, or those cameras now where people are being told don't walk into a meeting with your notes exposed, because the book has the feel of loads of those things that have been leaked or sort of
the fact that politicians now actually within seconds of being out of office publish their diaries and memos makes me wonder whether they sat in a cabinet meeting and thought, should I vote for this or should I vote against this, because it'll be an interesting chapter in the book if I vote against.
What could I say here that will seem interesting when I write it down? Yeah, almost as if they're behaving in character with a view towards making for an interesting autobiography later on.
That's really
weird. Because presumably if they do something a bit mad, then there's a higher offer on the table.
Exactly. Phoning their editor going, I'm on the common now, I'm being approached, what should I do?
Yeah, punch the man in the face. then the things, you know, then your rate's gone up.
Exactly. The premise of this is that this is a file, a sensitive government file that I think was left on a train.
Malcolm's left it on the train up to Glasgow.
And it includes email conversations between the characters. So there's a conversation between the characters. There's a great bit, which is Malcolm's guide to managing your public image and his instruction on how to deal with Paxman and people like that. None of which we can quote on the radio.
No.
None of it at all. Well, there's some really good material in there. When you wrote some of that, was there a bit of you thinking, I could save this for the next series?
No, because it's got to... I think stuff is only funny if it fits the form in which it's been written. So, you know, we all decided, five of us wrote it together, we decided we weren't going to use any of the material from the TV show because that material was used for television. And this is a book. But it does free you up.
It's good you're saying this is a book. I mean, that's one of the things I like about it as well is now, you know, we're treated now like we're content providers. Right? We're supposed to create
multi-platform
content for multi-platform things. And that is a book, right? That is actually a book, right? It's not a source of content. It's designed to look like what it is, a file of abandoned information, and it's not also going to be a video game.
We are bringing out a Malcolm Tucker app quite soon.
Is that true?
Yes,
that's actually true.
We've been working quite hard on it.
And what happens in it?
It turns your phone into Malcolm's phone. So when you activate it for 30 days, you will get calls from Malcolm.
This is great. Emails. When's it out?
December. We're still doing.
Has that been announced? I haven't heard about that.
Not yet. No,
the Malcolm Tucker app.
So just to qualify what you said, Stuart, about the book, it's a book / revenue stream. That's what you're told these things are.
And you're a content provider.
I'm a content provider.
Oh, Amanda, just very quickly before we get the news, in the next series, Thick of It, will the regular characters be back? Because Malcolm would be in opposition now. Will Malcolm definitely?
they be back?
Absolutely, absolutely. But we want to see what they get up to in opposition. But also there is a government. And, of course, there's a whole new party.
Terry Coverley, is she coming back?
She's permanent. She's civil service. So she's...
She was... Well, Joanna Scanlon was in here the other day and she was concerned.
Well, she shouldn't be.
Good.
If she'd done her research, she'd know that the civil servants don't disappear.
Exactly. So pretty much all the regulars back,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Well, that was Armando Iannucci and Stuart Lee. Your podcast hero emails in a moment. Now, though, here's this week's help. The most important part of the programme. I know it's my favourite bit. Tell me now what you're struggling with. And between this week's panel of assembled experts and you, the wider listening community, the family, we'll try and see you right. There's a particular focus today on cooking, with Phil Vickery.
Hello, Richard.
Hello, Phil. Cleaning with Annette Hayward.
Hi, Richard.
And etiquette with Jean Brooks-Smith.
Hello, Richard.
Hello, Jean. Welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
Let's go to David in Rushton in Northamptonshire. David, good afternoon to you.
Help, Richard. I'm cold. I've got a radiator that's not warming up. What can I do?
Well,
you're shivering.
Well,
you can probably tell.
Well, can anyone... I mean, this is... I'm not sure... Phil, you might be... You're a man.
Well,
can you deal with this?
I was listening to the other today about you not being able to do this and saw bits of wood and put shelves up.
Is that when we had James May?
Yeah. Well, they're pretty neat bleeding. Is there a lock in there?
Help, please. I'm sitting here freezing.
Well, I'll tell you what you've probably got. You need a radiator key, which you can buy from any hardware store. Have you bled them?
I've bled them, yeah.
Really?
And I've, And I've twiddled with both ends of it, the thermostat, and somebody said it's probably not balanced, so I've had a pair of pliers to it, and I've tried that, and we're still freezing.
There's a boiler light?
Yeah.
Oh, well, yeah.
David, are you saying it's two of your radiators won't work, or all the radiators in your house?
No, there's two of them. The one in the living room's toasty, so that's okay.
Can't you just move into the living room for a bit?
Yeah, do that. But the one in the hall, which puts heat up to upstairs, because her indoors didn't want radiators in the bedroom... Mm. Would you believe? Makes the rest of the house warm. That is the worst one.
It's nice to hear the phrase "her indoors." I've not heard that for 15 years. Dave, have you had the system flushed?
Yeah, that's been done.
Do you know what, David? You sound like a man in distress. We are putting this out there to the wider listening community.
I need help.
David, keep listening, and we'll see what solutions people send in. Good luck.
Lovely. Thanks, Richard.
You can help David. Start your text with the word "solution" and send it to 85058. Help, how do I get toothpaste out of the carpet, please? Says Heather in Sheffield. Annette Hayward.
I'll take some warm water with a little bit of borax in, make it up to a little paste, and then dab that on, leave that for a few minutes, and then wipe that off. But dab it, don't scrub it, because you ruin the pile of the carpet. You need to dab.
Dab it. Okay, dab. Heather in Sheffield, you've been helped. Help, says Jimmy in Wakey. I'm an atheist, but the rest of my family are not. How can I avoid church this Christmas without offending anyone? Let's go to our etiquette expert, Jean Brooks-Smith.
Oh, heavens, yes, and don't offend, especially with religion. I mean, there are terrible things you don't talk about, religion and politics. I think you're going to have to just neatly get out of it. Perhaps something very dramatic has happened and you can't actually go with them. But, you know...
Lie.
Not really lie.
It sounds like another breach of etiquette.
No, but just say something, perhaps, you know, it's Christmas, perhaps you've got to do the cooking yourself, and, you know, it might be time-consuming, etc. But, or just, you know, be honest and say, look, I'm not very religious, I do have my different views, and you go on together, and I'll get on and prepare something for you when you come back.
Now, I think, I thought about that, why not just say you don't believe, and presumably his family know that, but perhaps they don't. He says that his son is doing a prayer reading. Now, would you say he should swallow his atheism and support his son in church?
If it's his son, I mean, and something important like that, I think you've got to be... I mean, that is important.
He should go, right?
I think he should go if that is the importance.
Jimmy, you're going to church Christmas Day. Fact. Christopher in Stirling. Good afternoon.
Hello, Richard. I have a solution to one of the problems.
Christopher, what is it? Which problem have you found in about?
It's the gloss paint on brickwork.
OK, and what's your solution, Christopher?
It's a combination. You use turps and also a thing that you can get from a builder's merchant called a rubbing brick. I'm not sure if that's the correct terminology. That's what I've been calling it. It's an abrasive... Well, it's slightly smaller than a brick, and if you just wet it, the surface with, well, the gloss plate paint with the tops, and then you can rub it off. It takes like a micro layer off the brick as well.
Well, that Heywood, would you verify that?
Well, I would. That's what I would have suggested.
What you're really saying is wipe the surface off the brick that's got the paint. That's it, a quite simple solution, really.
Yeah.
You just smash the front off the thing, and then the paint goes, right?
I wouldn't smash the front off the thing. You've got to rub it gently.
That's the premise, though, isn't it? You take the front off the brick and it all goes. Christopher, I'm always impressed with people who phone up with solutions, because you're not phoning up for help that you need. You're just being generous.
I've had that problem myself before because I'm a labourer and not very good at painting.
This is the big society in action, isn't it? Christopher, you have helped. Thank you, Christopher. 0500 909 693. It is free from most landlines. It costs you a bit of money from a mobile. Call with solutions and call with your own problems. We're here for you. Jean Brooks-Smith is here for you. Phil Vickery and Annette Heywood. Phil, just before the travel, what's your dish of the week? What have you been cooking with this week?
Well, I'll go back to this hole in the ground thing again.
I'm still
working it. And I nearly brought you a picture today to show you, but I forgot it left in my
desk.
This
is, for anyone's missed this, is Phil digs holes in ground and cooks lamb slowly over 3 days. No one's got time to do that. No one wants to ruin their garden.
No, but you did ask me.
Have you got any, like, dish of the week?
Dish of the week? Probably be a brined pork chops, which you're going to do tonight.
Yeah. How do you do it?
Well, you make a mixture of sugar and water, and you bring that to the boil, reduce it down. You then put it back to its original volume, put your pork chops in for 20 minutes, take them out, pat them dry, cook them, and they eat like fudge.
David phoned early. He was distressed, wasn't he, Phil, about his radiator?
Very stressed, yeah.
Adrian in Battersea has phoned up with a solution, and I believe, Adrian, you're a heating engineer.
I am a heating engineer, yes.
What's David doing wrong, Adrian?
The question is, has he got thermostatic valves on the radiators? Because a lot of people have, and what they don't realise is that the pins on the thermostatic valves stick down.
Right, so what do you do about that?
Well, you really need a heating engineer, because they need tapping. They can be tapped, and I can get them to work.
But you're just punting for work, Adrian, right?
No, I don't need work. Let me assure you, I do not need it. But I'm not punting for work at all. I just work in London and around London. But the pin on the thermostatic valve, so if you've got somebody with an individual or a couple of radiators not working, the relevant question should be, have you got thermostatic valves fitted?
Thank you, Adrian. Okay. And hopefully David is listening. He can investigate that and perhaps call a heating engineer. Thank you, Adrian. Always impressive when people phone up and help other people, isn't it?
Yes, I think he was plugging with business.
Maybe for his industry rather than for himself personally. Yes. George in Brixton. Yeah, good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon, Richard. Can you help me, please?
Yes, we'd be only too pleased, George, but how?
Right, okay, I've got a bathroom cabinet, mirrored fronts, yeah?
Yeah.
And there's a sort of rust or condensation has got inside, and it's giving that rusty effect. And it looks like dirty tea stains and whatever. And it's looking rather ugly. I don't want to replace the whole cabinet.
So your stainless steel mirror's condensed, yeah? Is that right?
Yes, the doors are mirrored.
Yeah.
And in between, obviously, the condensation has got in somehow.
Okay, well, let's go over to Annette Heywood straight away, urgently, for cleaning. And now, what would you say to George in Brixton?
Okay, well, what you could do is, if you get some borax and mix it with a little bit of lemon juice and a little bit of vinegar, make it into a paste. And if you rub that on the stainless steel, that will remove the rust. If it's got behind the mirror, you may be able to just take the mirror panels off and replace them rather than replace the whole cabinet.
Right. What was that, borax with?
Borax with a little bit of vinegar and a little bit of lemon juice. Make it into a paste and then rub it gently with a soft cloth, and that should get rid of the rust deposits for you.
But how does that get inside then? Because it's a very, very fine, it's less than a millimetre gap.
Okay, you could use a toothbrush. Use an old toothbrush, not one that you're currently using.
Yeah.
Take an old toothbrush and dip that in the paste and then rub that gently, and that should do it. That you can get into quite fine little crevices and crannies and nooks with the toothbrush.
Right, there we go. George, how about that?
Yeah, well, obviously it's quite helpful if it works. And I'm just thinking of, once I rub it in and rub it into that little gap, the millimetre gap, then
quickly, George.
Obviously once it's gone in, I can't get it back out, can I?
Yeah, you just rinse your toothbrush in warm water and then rub it in the same area, and that will rinse out any of the stuff you put in,
George,
and then wipe it dry.
Okay. If you say I've been helped, you'll get a round of applause.
Right, thank you very much indeed for helping.
Okay, thank you, George. Thank you. Not having one. He's not. No way.
He wasn't impressed with that.
He did not qualify for a round of applause.
I tried.
Yes, you did, Annette. Let's have a look at some other ceremony coming in. Help, my wife has shrunk all my favourite T-shirts. Is it possible to unshrink them, says Nate. Anyone got any thoughts on that at all? It's not really, is it?
Very much.
You just like put them on and stretch them out a bit.
You can stretch them a little bit, can't you?
Yeah.
You wet them, damp them, and then stretch them. Does that work?
Yeah, a little bit. Not that much, though.
I just say you put on weight.
Use them as dolls' clothes.
Use them to charity.
Give them to charity. Just use them as a dishcloth.
Or your kids can wear them.
Yeah, or the children. Yeah, exactly.
Solution of white paint on brickwork, scrub with sand or soil, says Simon in Newcastle. Help, my problem is a two-year-old who refuses to sleep past 5 a.m. The result is a grumpy toddler and a grumpy mum with dark circles under her eyes. This is from Jack's mum in Sheffield. Who can help with that? Anyone got any thoughts? Jean Brooks-Smith, you have.
Yeah, I'm just wondering whether the child is crying and whether they're just going into the child to stop it crying. And I believe, being a mum, you've got to let children actually cry, and they've got to get into a system that is your way.
So your message to Jack's mum is when the child is crying, just ignore it. Don't go into the bedroom at 5 a.m. and see it there.
And I think the child will, I think from past experience, will, give up in the end. I mean, we all want to go in and pick this child up, etc. But you've got to train children.
Okay. Phil,
is that wrong, Phil?
No, I'm
questions
just
coming in. Pasta. Question. Yeah. Is it fattening pasta?
Yeah, it is extremely fattening.
It's extremely that's not.
Because it's carbohydrate.
Pasta's good for you, surely.
Well, it's fattening.
Next, you're going to tell me
bread's fattening. No. Look, there's two distinct areas here. You said to me, is it bad for you? No, or is it fattening? Yes, it is fattening because it's pure carbohydrate. That's what it's all about. The most important thing is what you put on it. A tablespoon of olive oil is 123 calories. One tablespoon, so that is why, yes, it can be fattening.
Olive oil's bad for you?
No, didn't say that.
I thought olive oil was good for you.
No, I said it was. I said it would put you get weight on, but cardiovascular-wise, it's very good for you.
So it's better than butter, isn't it?
Yes, you could argue that there's a percentage difference, yes, in fat, saturated fat content.
It's better than, I don't know, vegetable oils and other oils.
Well, all oils are roughly 600 calories for 100 mils. Mm.
If a push, is olive oil a bit
I would use olive oil, yes, but don't use too much. That's the secret.
So when I do, at home I make like a vegetable pasta.
Yeah, you chuck on loads of olive oil.
But to me, I think that's my healthy dish because there's not meat in there and it's and that's fattening, right?
It depends.
And I put cheese on.
There's a very clear distinction between fattening and healthy. So fattening can be very good for you, i.e. olive oil is very good for your heart.
Who cares about healthy? You just want to not be fat, right? I mean, to me, that is healthy.
Well, not necessarily. What about your heart? You can still go to work your heart. Yeah. Cardiovascular-wise, you could be extremely unhealthy.
If you're thin, your heart will be all right.
No, just...
Come on.
Richard, 100 mils, which is that much in a measuring jug, is 600 calories of any oil. Bear that in mind. So when you drizzle it over, like you obviously do, as I can see from here, that's what happens.
Is bread
bread can be fattening, yes. So a lot of it's made...
Should you not eat bread at night?
No, a lot of it is made in the high-speed process, which is a lot of oil, a lot of fat in there, and a lot of yeast.
Sugar.
A little bit of sugar, yeah.
Mm. Well, that's upsetting.
That's not. Don't eat too much volume. Option. You're eating too much volume.
Martin in Birmingham. Good afternoon.
Richard, help.
Oh, Martin, we'd be only too pleased, but how?
Oh, thank you. We've got a glass window, a sliding glass window, and above it a flat roof. And between the flat roof and the glass window is about 4 courses of bricks. And every time it rains, the water sits on the flat roof, then it seeps through the brickwork and drips down the window, and it's left a stain all the way down the window, several streaky stains all the way down the window, which we cannot get off for love nor money. We've tried methylated spirits, vinegar, various acids, various alcohols.
Annette, this is a problem for you. We've tried the vinegar. That's pretty much the advice that you tend to give anyone with a stain, isn't it?
Vinegar doesn't work.
What's your message for Martin in Birmingham, Annette Hayward?
Well, I'd install some guttering to stop the water running down the
good.
Window.
That's a good start.
We have actually stopped it running down by...
Oh, that's good.
But it's the past residue that's left from the past 10 years.
And what he's doing is he's phoning in to speak to someone that I have billed as a cleaning expert, Annette Hayward. The guttering is in. Now he needs to get the stain off that window. Correct. What does he do, Annette?
It might be hard water build. If it's been going for 10 years...
Well, we're not in a hard water area, so the water's come through the cement.
Okay, might have to put that out there, I think.
Right, okay, 850-58. Might have to come back to it next week. Martin, you've not been helped, I'll be honest.
Can I just say
yes, quick, Jean, quickly, go.
Something like that happened to me, and I used a loo cleaner, and it got the mark off.
Because
I've been scraping away. It's from a drip from the top of my window, and we used a well-known bleach that goes down the loo, and it worked.
All right, Martin, try that. Thank you very much.
I'll try a well-known bleach.
There we go.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Martin. You've been helped, I hope. And next week, we'll just get Jean to do etiquette and cleaning.
Sorry.
Yeah. These are straight and austerity times, so we're going to have to make some cuts, and I think we've just found a cut.
Sorry, Anders.
Help, I'm cooking the starter for 17 members of my family at Christmas. 17. I don't want to make the usual prawn cocktail or soup. I want to make something that they will all go wow to. Andy in Coventry would like a suggestion from Phil Vickery.
Was loads, but what about smoked salmon roulade? Very easy. Buy smoked salmon. You then put up equal quantities of cream cheese and smoked salmon together. Chew it up in the machine. Bit of brandy to it. Bit of salt and pepper. Lay it into your salmon, roll it up and chill it in a cling film sausage and slice it. Very easy, very simple. There you go.
Andy in Coventry, you've been helped. Christmas saved. Martin Milton Keynes, I have a solution to the black stuff on the iron problem. Sprinkle salt onto a newspaper and run your iron over it. Then rub the iron over an unwanted cloth, T-shirt, towel. It comes straight off. Let's go to, very quickly, John in Hinckley. John, good afternoon.
Hello.
John, you have a solution.
Yes, I do. It's the young lady that's got the squeaky clutch.
Yes, that's right. That's Gail. What's your solution, John?
It sounds like the clutch release bearing, which needs renewing.
Okay, there we are.
Unfortunately, it means separating the clutch from the engine, and that's not going to be cheap.
Right, so she needs to go to a professional, John. That's your message.
Yes, she would, yes.
Okay. Or buy a new car, of course.
Or buy a new car, yes.
Thank you, John. A round of applause for John. John, you helped. That's what he did. That's it, we're out of time, really. And so many other texts came in. Jean Brooksmith, thank you for contributing on two different topics. Thank you. Well, that's it for another edition of the Daily Bacon. Shall we look at the Podcast Hero emails, everybody?
Yes.
Oi Bacon, really enjoyed the podcast. So much, in fact, that I nearly paid my television licence fee.
Well, that's a disgrace. You shouldn't have read that out.
Hang on a minute. He lives in Tennessee. So.
Well, he could just send us a check, couldn't he?
If you only listen to the radio, you don't have to legally, you don't have to pay a licence fee, do you, anyway?
No, that's not true.
Isn't it?
If you consume BBC content live, then you have to pay the licence fee.
I'm sure it's only if you watch. It's called a TV licence, Robin.
It's not.
It's called a TV licence.
It's not. You have to pay for everything. You have to pay if you're consuming live BBC programming.
Because if they don't pay, none of us get paid,
no.
Basically. Steve Harper there in Columbia, thank you. He goes, I really enjoy the TV reviews, even though I don't get to see the TV shows. Robin, sorry, not so much.
Well, fair enough. I think that probably reflects the opinion of nearly everyone listening.
No, we read out
podcast.
One in yesterday's podcast. It was a big fan of yours. In fact, said they prefer you to me. Hello, Richard. This is Matt Bell. I'm a podcast hero listening all the way in Leeds. As you read this out, I'll be coming to the end of my run around Waterloo Lake in Roundhay Park, as you usually provide my soundtrack along with the swans and geese. So a couple of inspiring words to keep me going wouldn't go amiss, says Matt. Just a round of applause, I think, will do. Nice to be in his headphones as he jogs away. Hello from Oz. My daily commute is now a highlight of my day, thanks to you, Mayo and Kermode. And Robin, says Paul. He didn't actually. I added
no,
the Robin
I'm sure,
just to make
I'm
you
sure
just try make you feel
yeah.
Better.
Thanks.
Constant downloader of the podcast here in Thailand, says Adam Ramsey, ladies and gentlemen. So many podcast heroes. Quite a few people pointing out, including Andy here, Andy Burson, that I say that they go the extra mile, Robin, whereas he says, actually, I've just subscribed once and it involves no effort at all.
That's a fair point, isn't it?
Even so, it's just a bit more of a faff to get it onto your MP3 player. We're also taking up space on your MP3 player. That's different to just listening live. You
and
then have to find and press
time.
Play.
You could be listening to something else.
Right, exactly. You're still the heroes. You still go further. And Paul here says, I like it when there's multiple episodes in a day, says Paul, the podcast hero. We can't get through all these. One from New York, there's Simon. Christoph, a German listener who's in Barcelona at the moment. Podcast heroes, everybody. Simon and Mark. Who's on with Simon and Mark tomorrow? Anyone know?
Oh, yes, I do. Colin Farrell.
Wow, great. Who's on our show on Monday?
Well, we don't know.
Annie, who do you think?
Oh, we do know.
Giles and Sue.
Oh, great. Giles.
And John Bishop.
Really? Mm. Oh, that's good news. John Bishop, Giles Corran, and Sue Perkins, Monday. Bye-bye.
on digital and online. This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
bbc.co.uk/5live.